Good morning. Let's get started. We're running behind thus far. I'm going to ask my vice chair to start the meeting off because I've been out for a period of time. And Paul, I'll just let you go ahead and start.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start our meeting off by asking the committee's approval of the agenda and minutes. If you've all had a chance to look at it, I assume, and I see that our committee is here. Ms. Hartley? Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye. Abstain.
Any opposed?
Abstain.
An abstention by Mr. Price. Okay, and now we'll move on to our administrative tasks. Now that they've been taken care of, I'd like to briefly review today's agenda. We only have one item on the agenda, and this is the required annual ethics training for board members. I'd like to remind everyone that today's presentation is informational, and to fulfill our requirements for training under the board's code of ethics, which was adopted in November 2016. Today's training will also highlight the changes between the code that was adopted last year and previous versions. Now I'd like to turn the floor over to Philip Staub, who is Metro's ethics officer, to begin the session. Oh, Philip's not here yet.
I thought I saw him.
I thought I saw him just a second ago.
So, Paul, will you lead us in the ethics training?
Oh, there he is. Okay. I was going to say, I thought I saw him earlier. Yeah. Mr. Staub, welcome. And you've been properly introduced, so you can start your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and board members. And I apologize for running a bit behind this morning. What I'd like to do today for our ethics training is to cover the changes most recently in November of 2016 and then move along to some common situations, and we'll discuss some scenarios. And this will fulfill your training obligation under the code. So actual conflicts in the next slide. This is mostly a refresher. It remains the same general construct that a potential conflict is some interest or duty that you have to an individual, a business, or a property that could be at odds with your duties at Metro. The potential conflict becomes an actual conflict when that individual, business, or property can be affected by board action. That's sort of generally speaking. So the code provides Article 3 definition of what substantial interests or duties are. Basically, these break down into things that you own, from which you earn income, loans that you may make, individuals or entities that you represent, and that you owe a fiduciary duty to. These also extend to your household members, the same range of interests held by your household members. The only change here was mainly for clarity. The definition used to refer to party now breaks that down into business and individual, which terms are carried throughout the rest of the code where they best apply. Under the other type of conflict of interest, apparent conflicts, this section was reworded. I think the intent is still the same, however. What was in the definition was it asks you to look into the mind of the reasonable person. That seemed like sort of a tall order. So under the reworded, basically, there are three things you look for. Another personal interest, something other than those listed under actual conflicts, of which you're aware, that would reasonably appear to interfere. And I know there's that word again, reasonably, but it's hard to define an apparent conflict without throwing reasonable in somewhere. So other interests, something like a friendship or something that a relative other than a household member holds could be the source of an apparent conflict. Now, under household members, again, the basics are unchanged.
Paul, I have a, you might
Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
I have a question here. In terms of a friend, I mean, that's the universe. I mean,
that's right. So I actually get to an example of this later. So if you let's say you were close friends with somebody who is employed by a developer who's doing business with Metro. That could be the source of an apparent conflict. That may be something that would cause someone to question whether you are fair and objective for a certain matter. Now, I will get to this, but an apparent conflict does not mean you cannot participate. You can make a declaration and just give some transparency, explain that, yes, I have this friendship, but notwithstanding that, I can fairly and objectively participate in the discussion of this development.
I think the definition is friends. I mean, for those of us who are in the business community, I run across all types of individuals in all types of fields. And I don't know whether or not they're involved with Metro or any other company. It seems somewhat nebulous.
Right. So the board corporate secretary tries to assist board members with those sort of questions. Where might these arise? Particularly with development matters, but in other matters, providing you a list of interested parties. So you could look at that list and say, oh, yeah, I do recall that I'm good friends with so-and-so at Developer X, and I ought to say something about that, provide some transparency, lest your actions be questioned later on. So is there something else I can help you with?
I don't think it's reasonably defined, quite frankly, in terms of a friend or when you're transacting business in your private life with other people, whether or not they're involved here or anywhere else.
Jimmy, how are you?
Well, maybe I haven't highlighted enough that the definition says of which the board member is aware. So if you're not aware, it would not.
Yeah, why don't we?
Why don't we have a sidebar on that? Because that'll never be answered to my satisfaction without further.
That's fine. If it's something that we need to revisit in the code, that's something that I'm charged with annually advising the board on, and I'd be happy to look at that again.
Let's have a sidebar later on.
Thank Absolutely.
Ms. Hudgens.
I'll tell you the kind of interpretation I took. When it said friend, because it said somebody you have a closer relationship with. And let's say you go to the beach every summer with person X or family X, and then all of a sudden you realize family X is coming into Ramada to do something. Mm-hmm. Is that the connection? Because if you say friend, it could be I ride Metro and I see different people all the time,
sure.
But I really don't have a close relationship with that person. And still we probably, in categories, we put those as friends.
Right, and perhaps I've caused some confusion here because the definition doesn't say anything about friends.
Okay,
I was trying to give an example of what might reasonably appear. The standard of reasonableness is perhaps in the eye of the beholder, and is problematic. And in those situations, I suggest you err on the side of caution. After all, the apparent conflict can be addressed just through transparency, so why not do that? But I would think, reasonably speaking, people that you happen to encounter in your day-to-day business or people who are mere acquaintances, I don't think would be that sort of relationship would reasonably appear to impact your ability to be fair and objective. Whereas someone, like you're saying, that you go to the beach with every year and spend that week with, maybe that is the sort of relationship that could reasonably appear. We'll have a scenario later about someone you share the holidays with on an annual basis. That, too, I think, would be the sort of relationship that could reasonably appear. Okay. Thanks. Absolutely, please stop me with any questions. This is meant to be interactive. Under household members, I will just pause on household members because I was beginning to explain what has not changed. What has not changed is that your household members' interests are imputed to you, that they cannot be employed by Metro while you're a board member, that they cannot have a contract with Metro while you're a board member, and for some period of time after that. What has changed is largely, again, definitional. Formerly, the definition of household members just said you're dependent children. In the current code, that's been updated to refer to IRS code. That helps you, I think, define what is in the scope of dependent child. Now, I will add a little bit to that, but then it gets to the point where it gets fairly complicated. It's, as you might imagine, in IRS code. It gets to the point where you might want to consult a tax advisor. But, and one other thing I wanted to point out, in our definition, it references the IRS code and then says who reside with you. That's not a code requirement, so that's an additional requirement in our definition. So it has to both meet the IRS code and, I didn't mean to call your dependent an it, he or she, needs to be a dependent under the code and be living with you. Now, under the code, there are people counted as dependents who you might not have thought of under the old definition. For example, a sibling who is under the age of 19 and for whom you're providing more than half the support. That meets the IRS code definition of a dependent child. There's also people who might be permanently and totally disabled and living with you. That would also meet the definition. So the scope has slightly changed in the new definition. It gets very complicated if there are dependents who can be claimed by more than one individual. I would suggest if you have that situation that we talk further about that. Okay. Then in terms of resolving conflicts, here, too, the fundamentals are the same, but for one change, and this is an old slide, so I thought I would use it and just illustrate the change by showing what's been taken out of the code. So actual conflicts are still always handled by recusal. Apparent conflicts can be handled two ways. One, by recusal, and this is your choice, to either do recusal or, with the approval of the Ethics Committee Chair, make a declaration that you can participate notwithstanding the apparent conflict. What's been taken out are really two things. One, there used to be a per se apparent conflict if you had accepted a contribution, and this was mainly looking at political contributions, but not limited to that strictly, of $25 or more within a certain time period. That was a per se apparent conflict. That was removed. Now, that still could be an apparent conflict under the general definition, but it's no longer per se. And that per se rule about contributions had a third method of handling it. You could return that contribution or divest it, as it's listed here. So all of that was removed from the code. So there's no longer an option to divest in order to resolve a conflict of interest. Another thing that was removed was another type of per se apparent conflict. That was when real property owned by your jurisdiction is subject of a matter before the board. Now, that could still be an apparent conflict under the general definition, but it doesn't have its own separate per se rule.
Question?
Absolutely.
Mr. Goldman.
Phil, does a conflict exist if the board and board members have no authority over a matter? What I'm thinking about is an issue contracting for a land sale that has been delegated to the general manager, which never will become a matter before the board. Does that still create a conflict situation for a board member, even if the board has no authority over the matter?
Well, I'm sorry to say it depends. Okay.
You're a good lawyer.
You're right that no longer meets the definition of interested party, but that's only one part of it. It's whether the action could be influenced by the board member. So the other part that you'd want to avoid is any sort of influence over the matter, engaging in the matter through other communications besides actions before the board. So the fact that it's with the general manager almost resolves it as a potential conflict of interest. It's just that additional step of potential involvement outside board activity. So just a little bit more on resolving conflicts. I just want to refresh you on what recusal means. That means no participation whatsoever, whether at the meeting itself or outside a meeting. At a public session, you would, if you're recused, you would step back from the dais. In a closed session, you would not enter the room. So if there are no further questions about conflicts, I'd like to move to gifts. Now, gifts, there weren't actually any changes, but I think it's very useful to spend a little more time on gifts and use our scenarios there, because my impression is that this is what the board most frequently encounters. So, first of all, the gift rules begin with a general rule against soliciting or accepting gifts from prohibited sources. And what are prohibited sources? First, they are the interested parties that we are talking about under conflicts of interest, but they also include interests that may be substantially affected by the board member. And when the source is offering the gift due to the board member's position, that makes the source a prohibited source. All of these rules also apply to your household members. So with that said, then, I'd like to move to those scenarios. In all these cases, I'm going to assume that you're not soliciting the gift, because there's no exception to non-solicitation. So first, we'll start with the USB thumb drive scenario. You're at the APTA conference. Parts Inc. has unsuccessfully bid on a supply contract with Metro. They have a booth, and they're giving away these drives with their logo on them. So in each of these scenarios, when faced with offers of gifts, I suggest that you work through these steps. First of all, is the business a prohibited source? And then, is there an exception to take the gift? And then reporting the gift. So is Parts Inc. a prohibited source? Well, interested parties, to go back to that rule, it says has or is seeking a contract or agreement with Metro. Well, they have unsuccessfully bid, that's what you know. So they are not currently doing business or seeking business with Metro. It's possible that they have another bid in that you might not know about, but that's not part of this situation. Or they have interests that can be directly affected by decisions of Metro. Again, they don't have a bid in front of Metro. So in this case, it's actually a close call. Parts Inc., I guess, is not currently a prohibited source. They're not an interested party. They don't, whether they bid on a contract or not, would not bring the matter before the board, so it's not going to be affected by your interests. They're certainly not offering the gift because of your position. There's a bowl of them out next to their booth, and people are taking them. However, in these sort of close calls, I would recommend you err on the side of caution and consider them a prohibited source, at least for sake of argument here. Now, is there an exception that would permit you to accept the gift in the first place? Well, there's an exception for gifts of less than $25, which I'm going to say that's pretty safely under $25. So you can accept the gift. Even if parsing is a prohibited source, you can accept the gift. But you would need to report it. Always remember that regardless of whether it meets an exception, gifts need to be reported. So you would submit, I accepted a USB drive at the APTA conference from Parts Inc. Okay, next scenario is our Chicago scenario. So and this scenario involves Developer Inc., who owns a property near a metro station. And I'm going to add, at which we have, at the station itself, we have an open solicitation for joint development proposals. Now, Developer Inc. has asked you to come to an event in Chicago where they are sponsoring and give a talk. Let's just say it's unrelated to the joint development. Now, all speakers, you and others, they're offering economy travel and budget lodging, so Developer is not lavishing expensive gifts on you. And also, you'll have the same meals that are offered to all conference attendees. So, first question, is Developer LLP a prohibited source? I heard someone say yes. that would be correct. Because we have this open solicitation for joint development proposals at the station, and the developer owns property adjacent to the station, they could certainly be affected by decisions that you make since those actions come before the board. So Developer LLP is an interested party. So is there an exception that would permit you to accept the travel, the lodging, and the meals? After all, they're none of which are they're not putting you up at the Ritz. They're not paying for filet. Can you accept those? Well, we have an exception for speaking engagements. And it states that you can get free attendance, which includes food, refreshments, and entertainment given to everybody else. So this specifically says that the meals are being offered to all conference attendees, so you can take the meals. However, there's no exception for the travel or the lodging, budget or otherwise. So that portion you would not want to accept, and the meals you would report. Any questions about either of those scenarios?
Mr. Goldman.
A developer is a company like General Electric, and it's a subsidiary that's bidding on the property near a metro station. And it's a different subsidiary that's contacting you to speak at the Chicago event that has nothing to do with transit.
Right. Now, the easiest part of that question is the conference has nothing to do with transit. That's largely immaterial. Although perhaps where you were going was whether you're being offered this solely because you're a board member. That could relate to that question, I suppose. The subsidiary, the definition of interested party does not speak to how attenuated that needs to be. So that because Developer is a subsidiary of the company that you're talking about, the parent company has given you this invitation. The parent company
or the subsidiary.
Or the subsidiary. If that parent or subsidiary could benefit from the potential land deal, they would be an interested party. And this is another area where I would recommend reading it broadly and treating them as a prohibited source, erring on the side of caution. If it gets to a point where it's a completely independent subsidiary, different management altogether, they never share information, they never share profits, I think at that point we're pretty safe in saying, okay, no longer an interested party. You would still perhaps want to ask yourself the appearance question. At the end of all of these, I think it's worth asking, all right, they didn't meet the definition, but if I accept this gift, might there be an appearance of a conflict that I'd want to provide some transparency on?
I'm going to ask the committee members and the other board members if we could let Mr. Staub get through his presentation, because I want to give as much time as possible to questions without running too far over. This is important, obviously, but and we just have a couple more slides.
Okay, so moving on with the scenarios, we're going to do the ticket scenario. So in this scenario, there's a consulting company, Mass Transit. They've never done business with Metro. They've never sought business with Metro. A representative of this consulting company is at your teen's science fair, recognizes your teen, and steps over and says, hey, got a couple playoff tickets. I'd be really happy if you and your board member, mom or dad, would come to the game. When I wrote this, I did not know that last night was going to happen. So I know it's a little sore subject. Let's hope that these are national playoff tickets. So in that situation, is Mass Transit Company a prohibited source? They're not an interested party. As far as we know, they've never done business, not seeking business. I'm happy to throw in they've forsworn doing business with Metro. Now, remember, though, that last element asks, is the gift coming to you because you're a board member? Well, under these circumstances, it appears that this representative sought your teen out in order to get you to come to this game. So I think it's pretty safe to say by appearances, these are being offered because you're a board member. So that would make them a prohibited source. I'm sorry?
Creepy.
Oh, okay. Besides being creepy, yes.
Is that a technical term?
I think it is a recognized term in our code of ethics. Don't do anything creepy. So now, is there an exception that would permit you to accept these tickets? Perhaps you don't have Appendix A to your code of ethics with you, so I'll tell you that there's not an exception. So under the code of ethics, you would not want to accept these tickets. So finally, we'll do the book scenario. And this is where I said we would get to the holiday example. And we're going to bring back in the developer we talked about earlier. So we already know that they're a prohibited source. So it turns out that you have a good friend, a long-term personal friend through your spouse. Remember, your spouse's interests are imputed to you. So this is as if Mike is now your close personal friend, even if you never really liked him. So you get together every Christmas and you exchange gifts. And this is something that you've done for years and years. At this year's Christmas, Mike gives your wife this lovely book. How does this play out under our code of ethics? First of all, we've already said the developer is a prohibited source, and Mike is their representative, should be considered the same. Is there an exception that will allow you to accept books like this? Well, not books specifically, but there is an exception that addresses personal gifts. And the things that you look at are history of gift giving. Here there's a history of you getting together with Mike and exchanging gifts, so that box is checked. Another factor that's considered, among many others that could be considered, but is specifically mentioned in the code, is who paid for the book. Is this coming from Mike, or did the developer offer it to you? Or pay for it, and Mike is just putting it under the tree. So that might be a question you'd ask Mike to know whether that factor weighs in favor of a personal gift. I'm also going to say that this is doesn't meet the $25 exception, let's just say. let's just argue that this is a $50 book. So while not meeting the gifts of $25 or less, it does appear to meet the personal gift exception and could be accepted. But that is something that you'd want to report again. All gifts that are accepted under the Code of Ethics are reported. Now, what happens if the gift is accidentally accepted? And I think the most likely scenario for that is going back to these playoff tickets. Your team, not knowing any better and being a big fan of the Nationals, takes the tickets. What do you do? You have a few options under the Code of Ethics. You can simply return them to the mass transit consultant's representative. In that case, I would suggest that you let me know. It would be good to document that and have it in your file that you return the tickets. You can choose to pay fair market value for them. And the code in that instance says consult with your ethics officer, and I would help you look up under Ticket Exchange or StubHub or stopping at the corner down here, what are the tickets going for these days, so that you would know what is actually fair market value. You can also surrender them to me, the ethics officer, and let me return them. I heard someone laughing. Perhaps they're thinking I would use them. No, that would not be appropriate. But that would be another way of documenting in your file how the tickets got handled. So finally, moving on to just a refresher, not anything new on disclosures. You're currently completing your annual disclosures. You either do that, that's an annual project that's also done within 30 days of swearing in for new board members. There are other documents listed here. I'd just like to highlight that these are, once completed, available for public review. And we've already covered that there are disclosures submitted by interested parties, and the information is given to you to guide you in decisions under the Code of Ethics. So that's my presentation for this year. Happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Staub. First, I'll turn it over to Ms. Harley or Mr. Price on the committee. Do you have any questions? We'll open it up. Any questions?
Yes,
Price?
Yes, I have a question.
The first question is, why would alternates be subject to these policies when they do not vote? Only in the absence of a member. So why would you subject them to this?
There is always a possibility that they can vote. We also don't know the degree to which they can influence a matter, of course, working with their jurisdictional coalition on the board. So I think for that and, for the public to have full confidence in the activities of the board, all board members are subject to the same rules.
Any other questions, Mr. Bolger?
When I filled out this year's form, it gives you a gut-wrenching feeling that you're not going to get it right, okay? Do you guys review this, our forms, and flag something that we may have missed?
We do.
Oh, good.
We do. Forms you turn into the board secretary does come to me as ethics officer to review. There may be things that I know off the top of my head. I can compare it to past year forms. We also do a simple Google search for each member, again, largely to assist them in identifying the interest, because many board members have a wide variety of civic activities or employment for them or their household members, and we like to try to make sure that it's complete.
Could I ask,
I'll let you know.
And Mr. Staub, I think it's fair to say that if any full member, voting member, or alternate to the board has any questions or concerns, they could obviously contact you at any time.
Anytime. Hopefully that goes without saying, but it's also in the Code of Ethics that you can ask for either formal or informal advice, either way. Happy to do that.
Ms. Potter.
I remember there was a provision in the Ethics Code that if all board members were invited to, say, an event, like a luncheon put on by somebody, we can accept through the, and assuming that we're allowed to accept the invitation, we can accept through the board clerk's office and board secretary's office, and that the board secretary will handle the reporting of that if we decide to accept it. And I assume that that's still the case. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think that's often the case under when all board members receive something is viewed as a gift to WMATA, a gift to Metro through the board members, and there's an exception that addresses those situations. So, yes, there's still an exception for that.
Mr. Strickland, did I see your hand? No. Okay. Yeah.
And just to add, in what we've done in those situations in the past, rather than having each board member individually report that, we report it as a group.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Staub. Thank you for that informative presentation. And if there's no other business, is there a motion to adjourn? Thank you, Ms. Harley. Second?
Please, I can do that.
All those in favor? Okay. Next, we have the Finance Committee, Mr. Goldman.